Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Monday, the 19th of June, these are our main stories. As hundreds of people remain missing following the migrant boat disaster, there are serious questions about the actions of the Greek Coast Guard. The latest on the deadly Uganda school attack as the army hunts for the militants involved. The Swiss fossil fuel vote and its potential implications for net zero goals. Also in this podcast,
Benji akaverengera tsangadzi zvakange zvakanyorwa pachidziro. Pakange pasina zvimwe zvakanyorwa.
A classic revolutionary tale told in a new language for the first time. Families across Pakistan are reeling from the news that their relatives likely died in Wednesday's boat tragedy near Greece. Hundreds of Pakistanis remain missing, with just a dozen confirmed survivors. Monday has been declared by the government in Islamabad as a national day of mourning. In a moment, more on the reaction in Pakistan. But in Greece, the Coast Guard's account of the hours leading up to the sinking of the ship is being investigated. Nick Beek reports.
On Tuesday, at 1500 GMT, our shipping data shows a vessel called the Lucky Sailor providing the migrant boat with food and water at the request of the Greek Coast Guard, at the location where it would eventually sink. But the Greek authorities claimed half an hour later the boat was on a steady course and speed towards Italy. At 6 p.m, another vessel, the Faithful Warrior, is seen in our tracking data travelling to virtually the same area after a separate request to assist. As late as 10:40 p.m, just 20 minutes before the sinking, the Coast Guard claims the boat was still on a steady course and speed. But the evidence of the previous 7 hours strongly suggests it has moved less than a few nautical miles at best.
The Greek Coast Guard hasn't responded to the investigation. Thousands of kilometres away in Pakistan, the Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, has called for immediate action against people traffickers, and Pakistani officials say they've arrested several people, including an alleged people smuggler. I've been speaking to our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etarajan.
Many Pakistani families are trying to come to terms with this tragedy because we are talking about dozens of people, and they left the country with a lot of hope of getting a good job, starting a new life. They can send money back home to their parents and relatives. These are the dreams they had. And some of these agents, when they go and recruit, paint a rosy picture about life in Europe, and then they charge a huge amount of money. For example, Shahid Mahmood, he was saying that he paid nearly $8,000 to send his son.
The travel agent had totally brainwashed him, telling him, "You only will be traveling for 2 or 3 days." My son was gullible, so he went along with them. He sent a message saying he was sitting with around 400 to 500 people and they expected to be at sea for 5 or 6 days. All this is very wrong. The government needs to crack down on all these types of travel agents.
How does the government address this and get to grips with this problem of people being exploited?
So this is a transnational crime business, the smuggling operations, where some of the masterminds, they sit in Libya and then they direct their sub-agents. And now Pakistani officials say they have arrested around 10 people whom they call as sub-agents. So there has to be an international coordination for how to stop this. People are desperately looking for jobs. What are the opportunities? You know, how can they survive in their own country without a job? And they also see somebody who went abroad, they come, they send money, they build a nice house, then it puts pressure on you as in the peer group in your own village. Mm-hmm. Why can't you go and then do something like them as well? So that is also a political problem because it is for the countries themselves to address their economic issues.
Anbarasan Etarajan, there's still a lot we don't know about the sinking, including precisely how many have been lost at sea. almost certainly hundreds more than the nearly 80 bodies which have been recovered, along with the about 100 survivors. But we are now getting some of the names of those who've gone missing. Mohammed is a 23-year-old Syrian refugee who's been living in the UK since 2018. He's been searching for his 21-year-old cousin.
So once I made sure that that was the ship that he was on, booked the first flight I can take to Greece. We heard that the survivors were moved to a camp near Athens, which is where I am now. And they were with him when the ship sank. And So they told me that he fainted 5 minutes before the ship sank. And maybe that's why he's not here. So, yes, they told me that he fainted and they tried to wake him up. And then the ship sank when the Greece Coast Guard was trying to pull it. And some of them were really angry about that. They are blaming the Greek Coast Guard for what happened. And they are also denying all these things about them refusing to be towed or them throwing food away in the sea and all of that. The lucky ones and those who survived and those who their bodies were able to be washed offshore were on the tub. And everyone inside has drawn deep down. None of them managed to get out.
That was Mohammed, who's looking for his missing cousin. The Ugandan army is continuing its hunt for the Islamist militants who attacked a school on Friday, killing at least 40 people, most of them children. In his Sunday address, Pope Francis prayed for the victims.
I pray for the young student victims of the brutal attack against a school in western Uganda. This fight, this war everywhere. Let us pray for peace.
We heard more from our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton.
The Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has added his voice. He's condemned the attack. He called it criminal, desperate, terrorist and futile and has vowed to send more troops to the area. The Ugandan army claimed to be in hot pursuit of the Islamist militants and said that they would capture them within 24 hours. That's not happened. They also haven't recovered at least six people who were abducted. And we've had some harrowing testimony just in from our colleagues at BBC Swahili who travelled to the school. They interviewed one woman living opposite who said she heard children singing gospel songs on Friday evening before they went to bed, and then they heard screaming. The woman who was interviewed said, "I've been unable to eat or sleep since then." Another family in the town held funerals for a father and son. The father was a security guard at the school, and one of their other sons is still missing, so they don't know if he's died or if he's one of the kidnapped people. And the father said there was a very heavy military presence in the area. So some horrible and disturbing testimony there.
And I imagine a lot of people in Uganda are still in shock about what's happened.
Yes, and I think in the terms of stages of grief, the shock is turning to anger and questions are being asked why there wasn't more security, because it's on the border with DR Congo. This group, Islamist militant group, the ADF, has been active for many decades. And experts have said it's a tragedy that should never have happened. There should have been greater security. So people are saying, where was the army? Why was there no response? How was this allowed to happen?
And you mentioned the Islamist group. What kind of things have they done before?
They do have an unfortunate list of things they've done. They were responsible or at least blamed for suicide bombings in Kampala, the capital, in 2021. A few years before that, they attacked another school in which 80 students were burnt to death. So they have a history of carrying out these attacks. They were created back in the mid 90s, and they took up arms against President Museveni and alleged that Muslims were being persecuted. Their agenda was originally rather mysterious, and they were considered to be a spent force until about 2 years ago, but they've been on the rise ever since.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton. The High Court in Israel has issued an interim injunction against a law that has given the far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir enhanced powers over the police. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports.
This is the latest episode in the showdown between the current Israeli government, the most far-right in its history, and the judiciary. The so-called police law was passed at the end of last year by Israel's parliament. The legislation was drafted at the behest of Mr. Ben-Gvir, who was also its main beneficiary. The law grants the National Security Minister substantially more authority over the police. This has caused great concern among Mr. Ben-Gvir's critics, who believe it risks politicising the police. The High Court has given the government 90 days to respond to its injunction. Mr. Ben-Gvir has said the move shows the need for the government's radical overhaul of the judiciary to be put into action without, in his words, surrendering or blinking.
Sebastian Usher. Now, do you recognise this?
He read out to her what was written on the wall. There was nothing there now except a single commandment. It ran, "All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others." After that, it did not seem strange when, next day, the pigs who were supervising the work of the farm all carried whips in their trotters.
I remember that well from school. That's an extract from George Orwell's iconic Animal Farm, a famous tale of ultimate mischief, revolution and liberation, which tells the story of farm animals rising up against their human owner to create a new and equal society. Published in 1945, it was once alleged to represent the former Soviet Union, but its plot resonates with many others around the world. That's according to a small and inspired group of writers from Zimbabwe who united on Facebook. And after hours of work and discussion, they've successfully rewritten the book in their country's national language, Shona. And here is how that paragraph you heard in English sounds in Shona.
Benji akaverengera tsangadzi zvakange zvakanyorwa pachidziro. Pakange pasina zvimwe zvakanyorwapo kunze kwemitemo mumwe wega waiti.
And instead of calling it Animal Farm, they've called it Animal Revolution. The lead translator, Patina Gapper, told Julian Warwicker why the change of title.
We could have simply called it Puaziremuka, which means Animal Farm. But there's something about the story that spoke so much to the reality of Zimbabwe. So we could do something a little bit naughty and talk about the revolution of the animals, but not just any old revolution, but the liberation struggle of the animals. Because when we talk about the war of independence that created Zimbabwe out of Rhodesia, we call it the second Chimurenga, the second revolution.
I wanted to ask you about the animals as well, because I think you use, don't you, different Shona dialects when each of the animals is featuring.
That's right. In the 1960s, the language was standardized for the schoolroom. So every single child who learns what is called standard Shona. But back at home, they are speaking the dialects of their families and their relatives, depending on where in Zimbabwe they are from. So what we thought we would do with the book is to have the narration in standard Shona, but the animals all speak different dialects, almost as though they're coming from all the four corners of Zimbabwe.
Does this herald the start of more translations? Are there other books that you now have in mind where you might take a similar approach?
We are hoping that this is the first of a partnership with House of Books, which is the small, intrepid Zimbabwean publisher that agreed to this wonderful experiment. Our next project, we hope, is going to be Things Fall Apart. We really want to translate Things Fall Apart into Shona. We also want to translate Ernest Hemingway. And at some point, we are going to tackle Shakespeare, because Julius Caesar, for example, is a very Zimbabwean story.
Patina Gapper. Still to come in this podcast.
Naturally, anyone looking at this video is going to be extremely angry.
Fury in the UK over a lockdown party attended by activists for the governing Conservative Party. In the end, it was a clear majority for a cut in fossil fuels in Switzerland. Nearly 6 in 10 voters approved government proposals to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050 in a referendum on Sunday. Under the plans, more than $3.5 billion will be spent to help households and businesses switch away from oil and gas, which is all imported, to renewable sources. The Greenpeace climate expert Georg Klingler says this will not make energy more expensive for consumers.
This narrative about higher energy costs when we go to the energy transition, when we switch to solar and wind and water energy, is just wrong. And people understood this because it's an investment that will pay back. And so we need to invest now more money than we would if we wouldn't do this. But it will be much cheaper than staying with climate-wrecking fossil fuels or going for nuclear energy.
Imogen Folks in Bern explains why the government called the referendum in the first place.
I think you can say there are two key things that led to the really very convincing support for these measures. First, the really devastating effect that global warming is having on the alpine environment. We can see the glaciers shrinking pretty much before our eyes. We had a report just last summer which showed they had got much smaller, much faster than even the experts had predicted. The other thing, the war in Ukraine. Switzerland, of course, doesn't produce any oil or gas of its own, and just about every house will have oil-fired central heating. There's going to be money for those households now in this new package to switch to heat exchange pumps, to switch to solar panels. I'm told we can even expect a massive solar farm in the fields in the next few years. The goal is net zero by 2050. It won't be cheap. Opponents had argued this could really push up energy prices. But at this point, Swiss voters have clearly decided that this is an investment worth making.
Imogen Folks. In the UK, a senior government minister has apologised after a video emerged of Conservative Party staff drinking and dancing at a party in defiance of coronavirus rules which were in force at the time. Michael Gove, who wasn't at the party, said the behaviour was unacceptable and indefensible. It was published by the Mirror newspaper on Sunday, days after an official inquiry found that Britain's Prime Minister at the time, Boris Johnson, repeatedly lied about rule-breaking lockdown parties at his own office. Our political correspondent Helen Catt reports.
In the video, a man and a woman can be seen dancing to the Pogues' Christmas hit Fairy Tale of New York. They twirl hand in hand in front of signs advising social distancing and at one point bump into a buffet table while others mingle and drink alcohol. In December 2020, socialising indoors with people from a different household was banned in London unless they had formed a support bubble. One of the partygoers jokes to the person behind the camera about the risk of them being streamed, bending the rules. Labour said the video showed a mocking of the rules. A still photo of the party first came to light in 2021, published by the Mirror. The Met Police investigated then, but decided to take no further action. A spokesperson for the force said today they were considering the footage. The Conservatives said disciplinary action had been taken against four people for the event. Michael Gove told Sunday with Laura Kunzberg that he was sorry.
It's terrible. We all accepted a curtailment of liberty.
Well, you didn't.
And then,
these people didn't accept
and then
a
we see this. And naturally, anyone looking at this video is going to be extremely angry. On a personal level, I would like to apologise to people for this behaviour. It's unacceptable and indefensible.
He did not, though, support stripping two people linked with the event of honours given to them in Boris Johnson's resignation list. Andrew Newton, who spent much of the pandemic shielding with his daughter Aniela, who has cerebral palsy, gave his reaction.
This video that's come out today is actually a kick in the teeth for those of us that have been fighting for our children and our carers that don't have a voice. And then to hear that these people in the party have been elevated now to a position in the House of Lords where they make decisions, it shows you even further away from us that they actually are.
Tomorrow, it will be lockdown parties in Downing Street that are back in the spotlight as MPs debate the report by the Privileges Committee, which found that Boris Johnson deliberately misled Parliament. There has been some soul-searching among Tory MPs over how they should vote. Some supporters of Mr Johnson had said they wanted to vote against it. Some Tories who intend to back the report are nervous of a possible backlash from pro-Johnson members. There's no guarantee it will go to a vote at all, but Michael Gove offered what might, for some, be a way out of their dilemma if it does. He said he would abstain because the committee had done good work, but the 90-day suspension it recommends is, he says, not merited.
That was Helen Catt. Finland has been hosting visitors from all over the world as it launches a masterclass of happiness, a course teaching people how to be happy the Finnish way, after the country was voted the happiest place to live for the sixth year in a row by the UN. Our reporter Stephanie Prentice has been finding out more about how to be happy.
The UN's World Happiness Report ranks nations based on data from respondents with a focus on the quality of life in each country. The goal is to use the findings to guide public policy and essentially try to put happiness in the spotlight as a goal for governments to strive towards. Step Forward Finland, who've been at the top of the leaderboard for 6 years running and are opening up about why they think that is and how other nations can do it too. The new course focuses on themes experts say are essential to Finnish happiness, like nature and lifestyle, work-life balance, and their approach to food and well-being. Petri Kokkonen is one of the experts. He's a wilderness guide who took Finnish principles to the extreme, moving to Lapland and leaving a busy life in Helsinki.
I don't have watch. I don't take care of the time. What is the time? When I'm alone, I can be just me and the nature.
Alex Nurmi is another expert, a TV chef who gathers ingredients like berries and mushrooms from the forest and says eating isn't just about food.
Sometimes when you're in sitting in your dinner table, put your cell phone away, put maybe some nice nature music in the background and focus what you have, those nice ingredients. Think about where they come from. So take more mentally the food experience.
People on the course so far have travelled from France, Germany, the US, the UK and China to take part in lessons on things like sauna culture, cold water therapy, yoga and mindful eating.
In the United States, we're always striving to do more. We're always striving to be better and level up. And I think there's a lot of discontent that comes from that mentality. And I think one of the things that contributes to happiness in Finland is this sort of contentment in the moment.
I feel like it's way more simple way of thinking and not being too much into looks, into everything that's superficial. It's more about enjoying the small things in life.
Sometimes it's really cold and dark and raining and freezing, but rather than saying, oh, it's terrible weather, it's ruined my day, they're like, oh yeah, cool, this is what we've got, so we're going to jump in the sauna and we're going to jump in the snow and just be happy with whatever comes our way.
The sauna is sort of a metaphor for Finnish culture and values, in the sense that it's this time to relax and be present and just enjoy the moment that you're in.
The team say that happiness is a skill that can be learned and shared rather than a mystic state. And so far, it seems their plans are working.
How would you rate your personal happiness out of 10?
12.
That was Stephanie Prentice. Sign me up. It sounds amazing. This week, a surprise discovery was made beneath a construction site in central London, the most intact Roman mausoleum to ever be found in Britain. That's according to archaeologists, who shared a picture of an incredibly rare and striking mosaic spanning across two floors, adorned by Roman coins and fragments of pottery. They say it was once a vast burial site for the wealthy and provides a fascinating window into the life of Roman settlers in London 1,800 years ago. The author and historian Tom Holland told us more about these sorts of discoveries.
The thing that is very unusual about London relative to most other capitals of provinces in the Roman Empire is that it wasn't originally a settlement. So there was essentially nothing there before the Romans arrived. And the original plan of the Roman occupation was to use Colchester as its capital, because that was the capital of the largest tribal entity in Britain. London grew up for the same reason that it grew up in the Middle Ages again, and London remains the largest city in Britain, I think always will be, in a unitary state. And that is that it is the lowest bridging point on the Thames and navigable out to the sea. So it grew up very, very rapidly. And in time, it became obvious to the Romans that it was a far more convenient capital than Colchester. And so it essentially became the headquarters of Roman Britain for that reason.
That was Tom Holland. K-pop, Korean pop music, is hugely popular in South Korea and many other countries. It's also steadily been infiltrating Africa. Countries such as Nigeria, South Africa and Kenya have seen K-pop boy bands like BTS and TV K-dramas gain legions of fans. So what's their appeal in Africa? And could we see an Afrobeat and K-pop collaboration anytime soon? Miriam Odonka reports. It's the thought of being
when your heart's just like a drum. The first song I listened to was Permission to Dance, and the song was amazing.
24-year-old Sane is a K-pop superfan from Kenya. While she can't speak Korean, she can sing it, or at least the lyrics to every one of BTS's hit singles. If you don't already know, BTS are a hugely popular boy band from South Korea. Since forming 10 years ago, the group has amassed millions of fans and has one of K-pop's most diverse global fan bases. They were assembled through competitive auditions and years of grooming within Korea's intense studio culture known for manufacturing marketable idol groups. 19-year-old Ghanaian Afia Duma has been following the group for 5 years.
Of course, there's a lot of listeners in Africa and other countries that they probably don't know of. Maybe after they come back, after their break, they will go to African countries, in my opinion. I think it's time.
Now, African pop has entered the K-pop universe. BTS incorporated South African and Nigerian dances into their 2018 hit Idol, and Penemeko using Afrobeat drum patterns in their track Bolo. Afia hopes that their influence won't become cultural appropriation.
As long as it's like not offending or trying to mock other dialects and other cultures, it's all right. They should only appreciate the culture and not appropriate it, and they should use it very carefully if they want to create music with other cultures. They should tread lightly.
Since 2022, sub-Saharan Africa has seen a 93% year-on-year increase in K-pop streams. But even with a devoted and growing African fandom, no mainstream K-pop groups have performed on the continent or collaborated with an African artist. With the ranks of the K-pop army ever growing, that may not be the case for long.
That was Miriam Odonka. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin and I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.